This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In all the mind-bending human disasters, some hope evolution can save us. Maine professor Tim Waring studied that. He worries evolutionary design may actually stop humans from solving climate change. Meanwhile, in these times of turmoil, Antarctica is accelerating into massive ice loss. According to New Science, a major meltdown can happen not in thousands of years, but in less than 200. That leads to a new age of rapid sea level rise around the world. Royal Society Professor Eric Wolfe explains. I'm Alex. This is Radio EcoShock. Before we get to our guests, climate heating is pushing extreme wildfires, releasing megatons of carbon dioxide, forcing more climate heating. You get the loop there. It's a positive feedback loop at work in the hottest 12 months recorded by humans and possibly in the last 3 million years. We are seeing new fire phenomena. A prime example, North Texas was in a state of drought for several years recently, but not this winter of 2023-24. Yet the largest single fire in Texas history burned at least 1 million acres last week, over 400,000 hectares. Several other major fires burned in Texas and Oklahoma at the same time. So it has happened before in March. Texas had two big fires, the Eastern Complex Fire in March 2022 and the East Amarillo Complex Fire in March 2006. But these were tiny compared to these 2024 fires in what used to be called the dormant season for fires. You know, February. Is climate involved? Studies have yet to come about this, but we can observe there was a long-lasting winter heat wave in the area with temperatures up to 94 degrees Fahrenheit over 34 C in Dallas, for example. Earth is experiencing flash droughts. According to our guest Michael Flanagan, some soils can dry out in just 3 days of heat, leaving vegetation ready to burn, even after a fairly rainy time. I believe that is what happened in Texas. These massive wildfires are not just local or regional disasters. Trees and bushes make trunks and branches out of carbon. Wood and even grass are essentially towers of carbon. When they burn, clouds of carbon dioxide go into the atmosphere. It has been difficult to find out how much carbon is coming from wildfires compared to our own emissions, but now with newer equipment, the Copernicus Atmospheric Monitoring Service, that's an EU bunch, they released fire emissions data for the South American fires that just happened. Not reported in the mainstream news, the northern Amazon, formerly considered a rainforest, has overheated and burned in just the last months. Copernicus reports in just the month of February 2024, wildfires in Brazil, Venezuela, and Bolivia released about 9.3 megatons of carbon into the atmosphere. For comparison, the total CO2 emissions from the American transport sector, cars, trucks, and trains, was almost 1.6 megatons for the whole year of 2022. That means carbon emissions from South American wildfires just last month are about 6 times U.S. transport emissions for a whole year. And all that is small compared to the 480 megatons of carbon released by the 2023 wildfires in Canada, again according to Copernicus satellite measurements. Wildfires in the last 12 months provided a major burst of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Those are the facts. Even the rainforest is burning. Some of that carbon will be recaptured by regrowth, but the dense forest ecosystem is unlikely to return. Whatever is not recaptured by replacement growth will remain in the atmosphere for at least 100,000 years of warming. The combination of high heat, extended wildfire seasons and flash droughts is now a positive feedback loop. I have been on this climate beat for a while. I did not hear anyone predicting wildfire would become a major driver of global warming in the 2020s. And yet, here we are. Nature is taking over the big change. returning us to a hothouse Earth. Let's get on to the hard science about rapid climate change, followed by the big question, can humans change, and can they do it in time? As the last ice age ended, the surface of the West Antarctic ice sheet shrank down about 1,500 feet or 450 meters. All that ice did not disappear in thousands of years, as you might expect, but in less than 200, in two or three human lifetimes even. As we rapidly heat the planet, be warned, Antarctic ice can change very quickly. So can coastlines around the world. New evidence is revealed in a paper published in the journal Nature Geoscience. Co-author Eric W. Wolfe is here to explain. He is a Royal Society research professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at Cambridge University. With 40 years of research and publishing, Eric is an honorary fellow at the British Antarctic Survey. From Cambridge, Eric Wolfe, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Let us begin with this startling new paper, Abrupt Holocene Ice Loss Due to Thinning and Ungrounding in the Weddell Sea Embayment. Your team pinpoints a fast ice excursion that happened around 8,000 years ago. Eric, where is the Weddell Sea and why do we care what happens there?
So the Weddell Sea is the sea just north of the Antarctic continent, facing the Atlantic Ocean. So it's the southern extension of the Atlantic Ocean. So we're talking about the ice that flows into that part, into that sector, which is a large proportion of Antarctica, about a sixth of Antarctica. And the reason we care is because the amount of ice that comes out of that sector is significant for sea level. So when, as we have established that it did, when it disappeared, when it shrank rapidly at the end of the last ice age, it would have had a pretty noticeable effect on sea level rather fast in terms of, you know, feet, not inches.
Please describe the location where this 2,000-foot-long ice core, just over 600 meters, was taken and why that sample is representative or important.
We drilled an ice core at a place called Skytrain Ice Rise, which is a dome of ice that sat in the middle of a floating ice shelf, the Ronnie Ice Shelf, and it's right at the back of this ice shelf. So it really feels what's happening in the ice shelf, which is land ice that's floating on the sea in a large sector of Antarctica. And so it's a really sensitive place to see what's happening to the ice all around it.
All scientists long for accurate records direct from nature. This study finds two in the ice cores, an oxygen isotope, and the amount of sea salt. Eric, what does the oxygen level tell us?
So the oxygen isotopes tell us what the temperature was at the actual location where we drilled the ice core. It's to do with the way that water evaporates and condenses as it eventually, as it comes from the mid-latitudes where it's evaporated from the ocean and ends up as snowfall. And it's not completely obvious why it should be telling us about temperature, but it's well established over many decades that it does tell us about temperature. And so when we see the oxygen isotopes change rapidly, that tells us that the temperature changed rapidly. And in this particular case, because we know that the temperature wasn't changing rapidly anywhere else in Antarctica, it tells us that the elevation changed. You know, when you go up a mountain, it gets colder quite quickly as you change altitude. And that's exactly what's happening here. When we see a rapid change in temperature, what we're really seeing is a rapid change in the altitude of the ice sheet, so a drop in the surface of the ice sheet. And then the second thing that we measured is the sea salt content, and that comes because at the moment the Skytrain Ice Rise where we drilled is about 600 kilometers or 400 miles from the edge of the ice. So it's quite a long way from a source of sea salt. We actually measure sodium, which, of course, is one component of sodium chloride, which is the main part of sea salt. And so what we find is that when the sea salt changes rapidly, what that means is that the ice age changed rapidly. In other words, the ice retreated very fast.
And how do the records of oxygen isotopes and salt compare to predictions made by models like the Parallel Ice Sheet model?
That's what's really exciting about the work. Previously, models have suggested that the ice sheet might have retreated very fast in this sector of Antarctica, and as a result, the ice at our site, Skytrain Ice Rise, might have dropped rather fast as the forces pushing it back from the ice shelf disappeared. Sorry to put it like this, for my modelling friends, that was always just a model, which means that you think this is what happened, but you've never actually seen it happen, so you can't be absolutely sure that this is what happened. So the beauty of our study is that we're showing that it really did happen. The model says that the ice should have dropped by several hundred metres in about 200 years, and we find that it dropped by 400 metres in 200 years. The model doesn't do such a good job of telling you when it should have happened, and so in that sense, our study is very helpful because we can say when it should have happened, which allows the modelers to choose which version of the model is actually the right one.
This paper in Nature Geoscience finds evidence of almost 1,500 feet of glacier depth loss within a couple of hundred years, but the amount of warming required to do that does not show up in global records that we have for the time. So what caused this very fast ice loss in West Antarctica at that time?
Yes, that's right. So we were coming out of the last, what we call the last glacial maximum, the last ice age in colloquial terms. We were coming out of that from more or less 20,000 years onwards. So there was a warming during that period, which was partly caused by carbon dioxide changes and partly caused by changes in Earth's orbit. But nonetheless, what's kind of shocking is that that warming you might have thought would cause the ice to retreat slowly, but actually what we found is that the ice resisted retreating for quite a long time, but then eventually, at 8,000 years ago, it went very rapidly. All of a sudden, the whole of the then grounded ice became floating ice, which removed the restraint from the inland ice so that the inland ice then flowed into the sea as well. So it's a little bit difficult to say what was the cause, in the sense that the cause was a very slow thing, but the result was something very fast, and we couldn't necessarily have predicted in advance exactly when it would happen, but it's not something we would like to experience in the future.
A while back, we spoke with Australian ocean specialist Matthew England about changes in the Antarctic bottom water formation, and that's the pump that really sends water around the world, including up the Gulf Coast and the AMOC. Did you find that changes in ocean circulation could be a factor?
We haven't said anything about ocean circulation in this study, although certainly the ice going into the Weddell Sea would have caused some impact on the sinking of water and therefore on ocean circulation. Well, at least one good question is what caused the ice to disappear at exactly the time it did? And it's likely that warm water getting in underneath the ice shelf is part of the answer, although exactly why it happened when it happened is not completely clear and is not something that we got any new data on.
In recent years, scientists poured research into finding grounding lines for massive ice shelves. They even sent robots under the Thwaites ice to capture ridge records on the bottom below. Why are grounding lines so important to the future of all coasts and coastal cities?
So the grounding line is the place where the ice is sitting on bedrock and then transitions to being afloat, so to being floating ice. So it's only the ice that's sitting on the bedrock that counts towards sea level because the rest of it's already floating. And so when the grounding line retreats, then you're adding to sea level. And the concern is that in West Antarctica, which is the part of Antarctica we're talking about, both in the Thwaites Glacier area but also in the Weddell Sea region where our study was, you have a grounding line that's below sea level, which means that it's at danger of seawater getting in and melting it from underneath, and it's on bedrock that's sloping inland, and that leads to a mechanism called the marine ice sheet instability, where once it starts to retreat, it carries on retreating until it hits another bedrock high, and in this case it looks as though it didn't hit another bedrock high until it reached its present conformation, and probably if we were to heat it a lot more and start it to retreat again, it probably wouldn't hit another bedrock high for a long time, meaning a lot of sea level.
And we should be clear for listeners, we are not talking about sea ice around Antarctica, which is in its third year of record low right now. This paper is about the massive ice shelves with bases well below the ocean surface. But these, as you point out, have already displaced their mass in the water. If the ice shelves melt entirely, does that directly add to sea level?
If the ice shelves themselves, which, as you say, are land ice that's already become afloat, if they just disappear by themselves, then that doesn't contribute to sea level. But the problem is that they're holding back the inland ice that is on rock. So if you remove them, then that restraint is removed, and the inland ice will also start to flow faster. And that's been observed to happen in recent years in the northern part of the Antarctic Peninsula, where the Larsen ice shelf disappeared. Seems like quite a long time ago now, more than 20 years probably ago, that part of it disappeared, and the inland glacier started to flow much faster as a result once it disappeared. So the same thing would certainly have happened in the past and would happen in the future.
For decades, we've been shown dramatic footage of ice calving into the sea. Tour ships take the curious to see it, if they're rich enough. In our minds, we picture that as the major method by which Greenland or Antarctic loses ice. This study suggests that is not the case, at least not for the Weddell Sea. Why not?
Well, there's a constant process where snow is falling inland. It's forming deeper ice, which is then getting to the edge and being displaced as icebergs. So it's a normal thing that icebergs are being lost from Antarctica and from Greenland all the time. But what we're talking about here is a much faster process where a huge amount of ice would have been discharged all at once. It would actually have created a lot of icebergs, I have to say, at the time, far more than routinely happens. So it's not completely the wrong picture, but it's just that what you're normally seeing when you're on a cruise ship is just the natural balance of snow falling inland and ice being discharged as icebergs externally. But what you'd have seen 8,000 years ago is huge armadas of icebergs going out into the Weddell Sea.
It would be dangerous to even try to go there. Now, for decades, we've been showing most news about Antarctica and sea level rise. It's been about the Doomsday Glacier, so-called, the Big Thwaites Glacier, and that's on the other side of the West Antarctic Peninsula from your study site. There's lots of action there. Should we be concerned more about the Weddell Sea side, too?
Probably not too concerned about the Weddell Sea side immediately. The concern of this study is that it shows that the process of very rapid ice loss definitely has occurred in the past and has occurred in the Weddell Sea sector 8,000 years ago, but we don't think that it's primed to go immediately in the way that the Thwaites Glacier might be. We think that you need quite a lot more warmth, and I think previous studies by colleagues at the British Antarctic Survey, like Caitlin Norton, have shown that you need quite a lot more warmth to get rid of the Weddell Sea ice, the Ronnie Ice Shelf, by putting warm water in underneath. So we're not immediately concerned about the Weddell Sea, but what our study is showing is the kind of generic process that's probably what will occur at Thwaites Glacier sometime in the relatively near future, and showing that it really did occur the way that we feared.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is ice and climate expert Professor Eric Wolf from the University of Cambridge. We're talking about rapid ice loss in Antarctica in the past and possibly in the future. Not long before this rapid ice sheet retreat, there was a global cooling event and a great inland lake over North America spilled out into the Atlantic, and it disrupted ocean currents and planetary heat distribution. No similar event is possible today, so how applicable are events from a planet 8,000 years ago to what we can expect now?
Unfortunately, we think they're quite applicable. The process that we've observed is that the ice sheet is stable against a certain amount of shock, which would be warming from below or above, but it's not infinitely stable, and something eventually it will go. And something may have pushed it over the edge, or it may just have reached its stability limit. So you don't really need, or at least we don't think, that you really need a particular impetus like a lake outburst. I think you're referring probably to the 8.2 Killier event, where there was a big lake outburst, which is just at about the time of our event. But actually, we're not convinced that that's the cause of our ice disappearing, even though it is rather coincident with that time period, because the models that we've been comparing with suggest that the ice is primed to go. They can't predict exactly when it will go. All we're doing is pinning down exactly when it went, which happens to be fairly coincident with the event you're talking about, but we're not convinced that that's the reason for it.
But once the big dump of Antarctic ice starts, is it likely to stop?
It'll stop eventually when the grounding line reaches a point where it's stable again. But in the case of the Thwaites Glacier side, most of the modelling work suggests that that doesn't occur until you've lost about 2 or 3 metres of sea level at least. And in the case of our event 8,000 years ago, it looks as though there was a similar 1 to 2 metres sea level loss in 200 years due to this event. And then it stopped, it stabilised in its present position and has been stable like that for the last 8,000 years. So yes, it will stop eventually, but not before it's done a lot of harm.
Eric Wolf, you also studied and published on the largest volcanic eruptions in the past 200,000 years. You found that one of the biggest cooled the planet for a period of years, but didn't set a pattern for thousands of years. Can you talk about that?
Sure, I can. Yes, we were able to study this by looking in a different ice core, actually, at the amount of sulfate in the ice. And what happens when there's a volcanic eruption is that it puts, among other things, it puts sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. This gets taken up into the stratosphere, the middle atmosphere, where it gets oxidized to sulfuric acid, which lands on the ice sheet. So what you see when you measure sulfate in an ice core is it's a relatively flat line most of the time, which is caused by emissions from marine phytoplankton. But then occasionally you get these big spikes way above the background that last for 3 or 4 years, which indicate a big eruption. You can measure how big the eruption were. So we've been able to log where the biggest eruptions of the last 200,000 years when they occurred. We don't know where they occurred. We've got no information on which volcano they were. All we can see is that you get these very big eruptions that are very much larger than, well, actually much larger than Pinatubo, for example, which is more or less a one in a few decades eruption. We were particularly interested in the once every 1,000 year eruptions, which would certainly have very big impact for a few years on the climate of the whole planet by putting particles into the atmosphere which reflect sunlight, but don't appear to have pushed the climate into any new state permanently. So they would have been very difficult to survive. They would have affected agriculture. They'd have affected weather patterns. But after a few years, it looks as though the planet went back to how it was.
Does that mean it is unlikely that volcanic eruptions will save us from long-term global warming we're causing with our emissions?
I'm afraid that volcanic eruptions don't really save us. They cause short-term climate shock. There are, of course, ideas around to mimic volcanic eruptions by putting particles into the atmosphere as a geoengineering tool to try and change the climate. I think most of us feel that that's something we don't know enough about to do at the moment. It would cause cooling if you put a lot of particles into the atmosphere, which might counteract some of the global warming, but it would cause cooling in a different pattern from the current warming, and therefore would cause changes in climate patterns, some of which would be positive, but some of which would be negative. Some places that are currently well-fed with water might become drought-ridden. Some places that are currently low in water might become flooded. So it's a pretty dangerous thing to try. And it also has the implication, which is the same one with the volcanic eruption, that you've got a cooling for maybe 5 or 6 years, and then it warmed back up again. So if you started putting particles into the atmosphere as a geoengineering method, and then after 5 years, for some reason, you lost the will to do it or you lost the ability to do it, then you get a very sudden warming to catch you on the way, on the rebound.
In 2023, you co-authored a paper warning sources for this important climate change information are themselves literally melting away. How is climate change deleting possible records of earlier climate change?
Yes, so what we do is to drill ice cores, so that's cylinders of ice, typically 4 inches of diameter, that we drill right down to the bed if we can in ice sheets around the world. We're pretty much okay in Antarctica, where in East Antarctica at least, where the oldest ice cores come from, it's very cold and you'd have to get a huge warming before you lost them. But in many parts of the world where we've got some very useful climate records, they're extremely vulnerable. So in the European Alps, which are the ice-covered areas closest to where I live, the glaciers are retreating and many of the ice core records are becoming unusable because they actually become unusable before they disappear completely, because as soon as you've got meltwater percolating through them, it destroys these records that we're looking at by mixing them up. So in places like the Himalayas and the Andes, some of the records that are being drilled by other people, I haven't actually drilled those cores, which are very valuable, are becoming unusable. And some people are actually trying to save them by drilling cores and taking them to Antarctica to preserve them so that in the future, when we've maybe got better methods for analyzing them, we still have access to those records.
Eric, you are co-author of three new papers since January of this year, and some involve very complex high-tech tools. Just for fun, I'll try and name one for one of our listeners: laser ablation inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. We can't go into that, but the point is, with new computer-aided tools, you can find sudden impact, as you did. Eric, could this science have been done even 20 years ago, and are there more discoveries on the horizon?
No. So a lot of this science couldn't have been done 20 years ago. When I talked about the volcanic eruptions, for example, we could measure sulfate 20, 30 years ago, but we couldn't measure it continuously and at high resolution. And you need to measure, in the case of the ice core I talked about with 200,000 years, that's over 2,000 meters of ice analyzed at 2 centimeter resolution. So you can imagine how many analyses that would be if you were having to do them individually and without computer assistance. The laser ablation ICP-MS that you talked about, I won't spell it out again, but that's a technique for measuring at very high resolution, actually resolution of about 50 microns. So that's one, and I'm not sure if I can translate it into the right units, but it's a way less than a millimeter resolution, which enables you to see layers that have become so thin that you wouldn't be able to see them with conventional measurements. So yes, there are things that we can do now that we couldn't do 20 years ago, and there will be new techniques in the future. People are trying to measure new elements. We're involved in some projects to measure isotopes of sulfur, for example, which do give us some information about where the volcanoes were, which again wasn't possible even 5 years ago, in fact, because you just needed too much ice.
As we wrap up here, is there any message you would like to leave with our listeners?
A message is that we really can find out what happened in the past. We're not totally reliant on just estimates of processes. We can look at some of these processes that happened well before we have observations, direct observations, and we can work out what happened. We have to be a little bit imaginative about it to work out how to do that. But this can really help us to get a better idea of what will happen in the future and hopefully eventually when it will happen, which at least can guide us somewhat in our efforts to stop it happening.
From University of Cambridge, we've been speaking with Royal Society Research Professor Eric Wolfe. Find links to all the science we talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Can our evolutionary design stop humans from solving climate change? A new study finds environmental competition and conflict between sub-global groups work against global solutions. No wonder climate talks fail as energy giants and consumerism compete to expand. Dr. Timothy Waring models the evolution of sustainable behaviors, institutions, and socio-ecological systems. At the School of Economics and Mitchell Center, University of Maine, Tim Waring is Associate Professor of Applied Cultural Evolution. He developed models, co-founded international working groups, and publishes heavily. From Maine, Tim Waring, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with this. French philosopher Paul Virilio warned humans are not threatened by our failure, but by our success. Does that fit in with your work?
I think that's a really good summary. That is a very concise summary of the research that I've recently done. What we find is, as we're trying to understand the long-term process of humans in the environment, is that we've been very much characterized by just our smashing success. And I think that has, in a lot of ways, got us into the problems we're facing with environmental management today.
And every year, thousands of experts and political leaders fly to a meeting to solve climate change. But often nothing substantive happens and greenhouse emissions continue to increase. Can your work help explain why?
Yes, I think it can. This is the question that I've been wrestling with for some time and trying to understand how and why we might be able to come together to solve global challenges, collective action problems like climate change, should be a primary focus for nations, international groups, for the whole planet and our whole species. And yet you see that it's hard to achieve. And so our work is trying to explore why that is, what we can expect based on what we know about human evolution, and then how we can use that to try to make progress in a new way on these challenges.
Tim, when you say evolution could work against solving global problems, are you talking about the slow million-year development of genes and species, or shorter-term social and cultural evolution?
I study human cultural evolution primarily, and that's mostly what we're concerned about. Now, human culture is based on genetic traits that all humans have, that we have developed over, as you say, millions of years, and those traits allow us to be the super social species that we are, where we're born and we have a very long developmental period where we learn language and we learn practices and habits and we learn to prefer different types of food. We acquire social identities. We acquire religious identities, perhaps. And that, all of that is culture. And the interesting thing about all of that is the culture that we inherit, now we inherit most of it, right, from our family and our friends and our networks and communities, is not something that we just create. Instead, it has been passed down and modified for many generations. And so this is the primary focus of the research that I want to share with you today.
Well, we're going to need global agreements, and they won't be easy. To reach net zero equitably, heavy consumers and fossil burners may have to give some things up. It's hard to imagine Americans or Chinese or international gangs or corporations getting together in sacrifice. Is the breakdown centered on nationalism, on race, religion, or what do you find?
What we look at here, I think I should talk about the study in two parts. We wanted to ask two questions in this study. We wanted to ask, how did this period where humans are threatening some of the basic biological processes of the planet, how did the Anthropocene evolve in the first place? And the second question is, what can we do using that information to help the Anthropocene be a more sustainable option for humans? You know, the French philosopher is correct in that we've been so successful that our success may be our greatest sort of problem. I think that's right on the money. And your point here and your question about whether the lack of agreement between nations or other groups is fundamentally because of politics or nationalism or money is a good one. It's actually not something that we look at directly, but the point that we see when we look at, and we can extend back indeed a very long time in human history and prehistory in order to understand how human groups have changed over time. Our primary sort of data for this was to look at what has been understood about the size of human groups, the types of materials and energy that they use, how many groups there are, how large they are, how complex they are, and all of these things, as we know, are largely organized by human culture. So when we form a society, we have rules and roles, and they might help divide our labor into different specialized areas so that we can effectively process matter and energy from the environment and use it to support a growing population. Now, the success is that we have been getting larger groups. Those groups have become then more capable because they have more minds. Because they have more minds, they figure out, literally more brains helps those groups figure out new ways to use environmental resources at greater intensities and at greater scales. This then leads to the growing of more groups, the proliferation of those groups, and that feeds back again. So then we have, for the vast majority of human evolution, even prehistorical evolution, in fact, most of it, we are characterized by an evolutionary ratchet in which the size and complexity of human cultural groups gets larger and larger. And that is linked with our use of the environment. So our use of the environment has gotten more intensive and at a larger and larger scale for literally tens of thousands of years, if not quite a lot longer. So that's the success at the root of our problem here. We sort of conclude that the Anthropocene is the result of human evolution. Long, deep-standing feedback processes in human evolution, which have allowed us to conquer environment after environment after environment as we spread across the planet. So that feedback process has been dramatically successful for our species. That's a wonderful thing as far as that goes. The problem that we wanted to look at is to understand how the environment has shaped us. This feedback process is only possible in an environment where there are more resources to consume and there's more space to grow into. And now that, you know, our species has largely filled up the planet, we're no longer in that same environmental condition. So the challenge that we're faced with is that the lack of cooperation that we might see here today over climate change, but that lack of cooperation might be an important signal that the challenges of working together on a limited planet, on a shared planet with limited resources, is different than the challenge of expanding and consuming more resources to compete with your rivals. Now, it might seem from our history that we have been adapted, especially culturally, our societies, our institutions, our technology, to be really effective at growing and consuming more resources in order to compete with rivals. That's the fundamental challenge that I think we're looking at in the Anthropocene.
Now we're going to toss in artificial intelligence. Will that break the models?
Has this acceleration put us in a dangerous spot? It seems like this acceleration has put us in a dangerous spot with regards to how humans are going to interact with global environmental challenges. So in order to do that, we wanted to explore the evolution of the human niche over time. We just compiled a simple list of the ways in which humans have interacted with the environment as their groups have gotten larger and larger and more powerful over time. And in short, we have certain cultural traits that are useful for extracting resources and energy from the environment, and we have other traits that we use to manage that extraction, right? So we, on the one hand, use water to water our crops, to bathe and to wash and to cook and for industrial processes. On the other hand, we also have systems that are about the regulation of water use. We have irrigation systems that deliver water to the right place at the right time, but not too much, right? We have legal and technical systems that are designed to allow us to share the water, for example, in the Colorado River, among a very large number of people and across states, so that it's not overused. Of course, that's becoming a challenge now, is that those water sources don't get refilled as often as we were used to. But the point is, we have two different types of cultural technology that we have evolved. One is extraction technology, the extraction traits, and the other one is management traits. Now, what do we learn about these? An argument that we make in the paper is that extraction comes before management. And this you'll see in environmental case after environmental case. When do we enact fishing regulations? Before the fish have become scarce or after? Well, it's after. First we start fishing, and then we fish more. And finally, we fish so much that fish populations start to decline. Then we get worried, and we enact fishing regulations. When do we enact forestry protections? When do we enact rules to stop pollution? When do we create rules about trash and littering and recycling? When do we create a system to find an alternative to ozone-depleting chemicals? All of these management actions and traits and technologies come after we have created a problem with an environmental resource or capacity in the first place. Of course, this is natural, right? We don't know about them, or simply there is no problem. But this is an important consideration, because if we are going to manage something at the scale of the global biosphere, we will need to solve some of these problems in a way before they become too strong. That's where it starts to become a larger problem. I think everyone appreciates that climate change, for example, is a global scale threat on a level that our species hasn't seen before. It really truly is. The science is unequivocal on the challenges we face with climate change. And I think those people who are looking at climate change, the challenge of adapting to climate change, and even more importantly, the challenge of mitigating our climate impacts and reversing our climate impacts, who are looking at that seriously, see it as the largest effort humans have ever undertaken. And it will be that for sure. However, there is a sort of belief, I think, among some in the policy realm that, well, we'll be able to solve this. We'll, you know, eventually come up with some solutions. Perhaps it's good to be optimistic. However, given what we understand about how human cultural evolution has been dominated by this group-level process for many tens of thousands of years, there's a very important additional challenge that we face. And that additional challenge is that we evolve most effectively as groups. We evolve cultural solutions to our problems in groups. And we don't really have an effective global level group. More importantly, we don't have a population of global groups. Now, why is that important? Population is important because adaptive traits emerge in a population. If one company comes up with a good way of organizing their human resources, that idea might spread to other companies. And that becomes an adaptation. And all of the companies in that industry are now doing this process, and it's more effective. That's an adaptation, and it happens in a population context. Same is true with nations and the emergence and spread of environmental protection agencies. We now have many different environmental protection agencies and laws and systems, and those are adaptations to conserve our environment. Now, the important point here is that if we're hoping to create systems that protect the global biosphere, those will probably be the most complex environmental protection systems ever, because the biosphere is far more complex than simple environmental resources like water, for example. So we will need global-level technical, social, and legal systems for managing a complex biosphere at the scale of a planet. We've never done anything like this before. The question is, how do you arrive at that system that can successfully manage a global biosphere? That's the question, because that's clearly the thing that we need to enact in order to be able to simply keep our grip on the planet, in order to continue to survive. So we ask this question, when would these global systems of biosphere protection and management evolve? Unfortunately, our conclusion is that we're not in a situation where they are likely to evolve. Why is that? The reason is the size and scale of these global planetary protection traits and systems is at the scale of the planet. However, the population of human groups that we currently have, the population, as you say, Alex, of subglobal groups, which means they accumulate and transmit and compete with each other. And what they accumulate in that process is they evolve group-level cultural adaptations at the level of those groups. So for the United States currently to adopt a carbon tax, how do they look at it? Oftentimes, policymakers will look at it as a short-term cost. It's a short-term political and economic cost for those policymakers and decision-makers. And that's the problem. They're not wrong, of course. It's a long-term cost for all of us not to adopt strong policy and adopt these systems. However, the point is, it's not just selfishness that's getting in our way. It's even the structure of our human cultural population, where we have a planet full of nations and a planet full of corporations that are learning from and competing with each other, rather than a galaxy full of planets that are learning from and competing with each other. In the latter case, we might see that some planets manage to protect their environment effectively, maintain and regulate their climate and their ocean and their biosphere, all of their biodiversity. On the other hand, in our current system, without other planets to learn from, we as small sub-global groups, corporations and nations, learn from and compete with other corporations and nations. And none of them is able to decide to manage the biosphere, and yet the task is fundamentally at a scale above all of them. So this is the challenge, and this is what we call the population structure problem of the Anthropocene.
Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.
Our guest is Dr. Tim Waring, an expert in applied cultural evolution at the University of Maine. Your work reminds me of Paul Ehrlich and Bill Reese, perhaps taking next logical steps of study from their concerns. You developed a tool called Cultural Multilevel Selection Framework for Sustainability Analysis. I hesitate to ask, but could you explain that to the layperson? What does it do?
A wonderful question. Yeah, the Cultural Multilevel Selection Framework is a way to understand when humans solve collective problems and when we don't. Nobel Prize winner Eleanor Ostrom is famous for her findings about a set of institutions that help people in almost any context, but especially small-scale groups of people manage local natural resources. We see now that the same patterns and the same institutions are useful in many cases, almost no matter where the human group is and what resources they are using. However, those institutions are largely considered to be part of the solution to sustainability. You can look up Ostrom's 8 principles. The question, though, is not just if those are a solution. I think in many cases they really are. If we can enact careful ways to regulate ourselves and our use of the environment, as Ostrom's principles suggest, and show how to, we can manage sustainability. The question that I try to grapple with is, when do humans actually do that? And what are the conditions under which we do evolve these principles, these institutions that control our individual consumption of resources in order to, first of all, share it more evenly, and secondly, preserve it for a longer period, for an entire group? And that's where the Cultural Multilevel Selection Framework comes in. So this framework asks that question. We really want to understand when people cooperate to preserve environmental resources and when we create and share institutions that help us do so. And it comes down to 2 interlocking factors. The first one is the more complex one. The first one involves the comparison between the rate and strength of evolution, that is cultural evolution, among individuals, and the rate and strength of cultural evolution between the groups that they're in. Imagine cooperating on a team, a sports team. If you don't have more than one team, then people might take turns hitting the ball or take turns with the ball, but it won't become a very organized sport. It won't become very cooperative. There won't be a lot of interesting strategy. But if you have many teams and they're all competing, people will learn to share the ball, and people will learn to develop fancy strategies. The same thing is true for the way we use resources. The question is, are groups competing to preserve their resources more than or less than individuals are competing to consume them? So if individual competition for resources and the individual driving need to be able to, say, put food on the table, if that's their primary requirement with regards to let's say, the use of fish, whether they're fishing or not, it's going to be very hard to tell them, I'm sorry, you're going to fish less, if they're simply trying to provide for their family. And so it might not matter that the rules change. The nation says, stop fishing. Individuals are simply between a rock and a hard place, and they'll keep trying to feed their families. On the other hand, if you have a situation where what happens is competition between groups and learning between groups allows people to share solutions that protect the resource but still allow enough resources for the individuals in those groups to persist, then it might be possible to find a solution. Now, let me give you an example. I studied the lobster harvest and the lobster industry in Maine. I did this with a collaborator and friend of mine, James Acheson, who has now passed away, but he was an economic anthropologist who studied them for over 30 years and published multiple books, including The Lobster Gangs of Maine, which I highly recommend. What we saw when we looked at the long history of this industry is that it went from an open and very competitive environment where fishermen, lobstermen, were trying to protect the lobster traps they put out because anyone could come and pick them up. So as a result, it became fiercely competitive. And a natural emergence was the emergence of groups of fishermen who would take turns patrolling and protecting all of their lobster pots. They're called the lobster traps. They're called lobster pots. Protecting all of them together. This then gave them a way to avoid that external competition. And then internally, they agreed that they each would not put down too many traps. They wouldn't compete with each other. They would cooperate with each other, and they would compete with other groups by protecting their resources and protecting their borders. That system led to a very stable and relatively well-managed and quite durable lobster harvest because groups were able to protect their own interests while also working together to protect the resource in the long term. So that's a really good example. This balance between how much individuals are competing to use a resource versus how much groups are competing to preserve the resources they depend on, that's the critical aspect, and that's the question that the multi-level selection framework addresses. So that's part one. Part two, though, is the size of the resource, the scale of the resource. The lobster example works, and it works because lobsters crawl on the surface of the bottom of the ocean, right? They don't swim. If they swam around like fish, it wouldn't matter if you patrolled a certain area of the ocean because eventually all of the fish that are there would swim away. A stable population of lobsters can be maintained in a protectable area. And so if you protect that area, then you can solve the problem of managing that lobster population for your own benefit with you and your collaborators. So we need to understand three things in order to predict whether humans can successfully protect and preserve environmental resources. The first is, how strong is competition between individuals to consume those resources? The second is, how strong is competition and evolution, cultural evolution, between groups to preserve those resources for the longer term? The balance between those will determine where cultural evolution is more effective. And hopefully, it is at the level of the group to preserve the resources. But it all won't matter if we can't have groups that are able to be large enough to fully manage the entire resource. So the scale of the resource itself determines the scale of human society and the complexity of human society necessary to be able to manage it. So, and we look to try to sort of understand how that might play out in the Anthropocene in this paper.
So, Tim, is there a community of bright and committed people working on this evolutionary problem? Tell us about the Sustainability Working Group and the Evolve and Sustain Network.
Yes, we do have folks who are working on this. I just got back from a very exciting and engaging workshop, which I helped to lead with my collaborator, Becca Kuhman, at the University of Dundee. She and I held a workshop, which was the culmination of 2.5 years of work and a lot of meetings by people in different groups. The workshop was trying to understand how we can use the science of cultural evolution to do sustainability research more effectively and to apply it in different cases in the domains of government and grassroots and community and business and nonprofit sectors in education. All of these groups, we had people volunteers from those domains talk to us about our ideas about how cultural evolution might be a useful tool for understanding how sustainable solutions emerge and spread. And then we collected their feedback, and we are integrating that into an exciting sort of synthesis, which we're still working on, combing over the findings and the results. But this is an exciting first step in trying to create an applied science of human cultural evolution for a sustainable future. You know, I want to highlight this, and I'll tell you about the other working group as well, but I want to highlight that our research and this paper, which, by the way, is available for free on my website, and I highly suggest that people take a look at it and download it. But this paper shows us that we don't know, even in theory, if a species like ours, which evolves with the characteristic patterns that we do, we don't know if we can survive on a single planet in the long term, period. It's unknown, even in theory. And this is a really underappreciated point. So we are trying to build a global research agenda to address this question. And we need talented and smart scientists. We need committed and capable practitioners in all different fields. And we are trying to build a movement, and we are trying to build an applied research agenda. We need to do basic research. We need funding to get this done. There is so much to do. And so one of the ways that we do this is we have a small, you know, applied working group in the Cultural Evolution Society, which has just launched a new website. That working group is trying to address these problems with the resources we have. And I help to maintain an email network of people who are committed to trying to make progress on this front. And the email network is called Evolve and Sustain, and you can also find that on my website, or maybe you could put the link up. We're looking for practitioners, and we're looking for scientists, and we're looking for people who can cross those boundaries well and are looking to make positive change for environmental sustainability using these modern cultural evolutionary tools. So please check it out if you can.
From the Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions at the University of Maine, we've been speaking with Associate Professor Timothy W. Waring. He leads a new study titled Characteristic Processes of Human Evolution Caused the Anthropocene and May Obstruct Its Global Solutions. It is an open-access paper. It's free to read. You can find out more at timwaring.info, W-A-R-I-N-G.info. And you can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim Waring, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
It's been my pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.